what you know about it.
It's the stew, baby.
Got the mise en place.
Young stew up, baby.
And the room a lot.
Hello, hello. You're listening to The Stew. I'm Jason Stewart. This is our food podcast, Andre Conaparo. Say hello.
Hello.
One guest today, Holly. What's good?
Helen.
Helen. Helen Hollyman. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I've been better overall, but I'm fine. I was we were out of town for a wedding all week, and then I had to like DJ the last two nights in a row. So I went to bed at like 4 a.m. the last 2 days. Ooh. So I'm a little mentally frazzled. But you were nice enough to bring some wine over.
Yeah.
That's going to maybe help. What kind of wine is this again?
Recharge the Jets.
Let's see.
Recharge the Jets.
I don't know. It's something from Lou. It is a white wine from France.
That's right. Well played. That's exactly I like the build up.
It's a white wine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah.
It's white wine. It's real good. Yeah. It's nice.
Just piping hot.
White wine, real
good. That's the way we serve it here.
Mm-hmm.
So, Helen, you're the editor in chief of Munchies.
Incredible.
The Vice magazine food vertical. Is that what you would call that?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is that?
That's it. A vertical seems like a made-up thing, but it's just a website where we put a lot of food stuff. So.
You're more than just a website.
No, I mean, I spend time on that website. You do an incredible job. I mean, this term vertical, is that like...
That's a thing that's been popping up the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. It means like if you have like if Fader magazine does like a separate thing that's like for encouraging like women in music, and that has like its own name.
Got
that
it.
Would be like a vertical, I guess.
Okay.
Where it's like a subdivision, but it's a little bit more than just a subdivision.
Maybe
a wing of a home. Perhaps?
Makes perfect sense. Maybe I'm just outing myself of being so out of the loop.
But it's like,
what's vertical?
When I said vertical, I was saying it sort of in jest because okay. I don't like.
It's a synergy type word.
It's a fucking synergy ass word.
Got it. Okay. Understood. Put a pin in it, kind of thing.
And you live in New York. Originally from Texas?
Yes.
Then you lived in New Orleans?
Yep. Yep.
So you live in like the three drinkingest places in America?
That's why I bring you wine at mm-hmm. like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You're
For our listeners at home, her skin is glowing despite her clear alcoholism.
Yeah. How really, do you do really it? Nice.
Thank you guys.
Someone buys someone spends money on products.
Yeah. Looks it's good. Sunscreen. It's sun, oh. you know, that's
never heard
what
of it.
What yeah. number SPF do you use?
Usually like 60. I'm not even kidding. Cause,
you are a white girl.
Yeah. we all are pretty white.
Yeah. Absolutely. We all could very
Does
much
Aesop
use
go
sunscreen.
Up to 60?
I have no idea. But I feel like if the three of us went to the beach right now, we would probably roast pretty quick.
How dare you?
You can smell what the rock is cooking.
Look at that damn
that
brown
nice.
Arm.
Yeah.
He does. Like he does lots of hiking. So he likes to.
Oh, yeah?
He likes to get out there.
I like to get sizzled mm-hmm. and then hit a cold shower.
A little roasty.
That sounds lovely. Although,
do you plan on hiking this weekend while you're in LA on holiday?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
He's got the routes for you.
Really?
Yeah.
Because even I'm afraid to go hiking in this heat.
Yeah. I mean, how hot is it at like 6 a.m.? Is it
doable?
1,000 sure. degrees?
No, it'll be like 80 probably.
I was going to say like, six. Yeah. I was going to splitting hairs, but yeah, like mid 70s. At 6 in the morning.
Are you? Do you do a 6 a.m. hike, though?
No.
Do you do a 6 a.m.?
I was just curious.
Wake up?
I was just curious.
No. No. Not if I don't have to. But I mean, you know.
I'm
going to
go hiking tomorrow.
At 6 a.m.?
No. Probably like 10.
Yeah.
Maybe 11.
What do you wear when you hike?
You want to go?
Yeah.
I wear
it's a fun hike.
I'm wearing
you
just little, like shorts and a tee.
Yeah. And then are you just like drenched when you come home?
Completely. Completely. Like... So fucked up, like completely drenched in sweat, dirty, gross, kind of smell bad. You know, there's like those little like sticky things in your socks and all that stuff.
But he'll be a bad boy and do that as cardio and then go work out when he really wants to hit it hard.
But I can't do that in this because it's like 103 degrees here, Fahrenheit, Celsius. That's what, around 40 or so.
What
for our international listeners?
What is your pre-hike early morning meal? Is there one? Is it coffee?
Ooh. So I don't work out as much as I should because I live in New York. So.
And you're busy, and you walk everywhere.
Yeah, but you know, I like to wake up.
You get a lot
of
steps in New York, though.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your steps looking like on the iPhone?
Let's go back to your breakfast.
This is God a fucking damn it, food Jason. Podcast,
okay? I need to know how many steps you take on average.
I had to turn off like the steps on my phone because I felt like it was too creepy how much information they know
you
about
were
you.
You putting in the cloud?
Yeah, it was a little bit too much. So I don't know.
Well, and you're in some nasty places. We were talking about that before the podcast.
Yeah.
Just kidding. You didn't say any of that.
Yes, I... Yeah.
I don't want people to know where I'm... Where I'm
at. I don't want Steve Jobs to know where I'm walking to in my private time. Okay, sorry.
Steve.
So breakfast routine. What's going on with that?
I don't really eat breakfast. Do you guys?
Same. No breakfast.
Yeah. I know it's bad. Like they say that you're supposed to wake up and like, you know, within 30 minutes you should eat something because it helps jumpstart your blood sugar. But I don't do that.
And metabolism.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll do... like a couple scoops of like fiber and protein powder with like some cider vinegar and water, just so like something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Or a piece of fruit, but that's kind of where
that's
it.
Good.
That's about it. Because I do subscribe a little bit to like something.
Yeah.
Something.
You gotta
other
get
than coffee and water. But I also could very easily skip it. I kind of have to force myself.
I haven't eaten any food yet today. I made a smoothie for a lunch.
This is his food podcast.
Why? Yeah, why haven't you eaten anything?
I had nachos last night at 3 a.m. And I wasn't
did you go to El Flamin'?
I did.
Yeah, my guy. My guy. There's a fun truck by his house.
There's a fun taco truck.
It has its
truck.
Own stoner menu. It's Ooh. Like good Mexican, legit Mexican taco truck LA food, but then they also have like the turn.
They have a 420 menu. Friendly the menu.
420 friendly side.
So what kind of nachos did you have?
I got chicken
jalapeno
nachos.
Jalapeno popper nachos.
No, they're not.
What?
But the jalapeno popper nachos reminded me of something in this cookbook that we're going to talk about for the last 3 minutes of the podcast.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Checks out.
Yeah, just to tease that in. It was just a chicken nacho, but because I was trying to be like, the chicken they use there, it's like very, I think it's stewed, like, breast meat.
Yep.
So it's a very clean chicken. It's not greasy or oily or fatty at all. So it feels like some nice quality, like solid white meat protein, even though chicken is probably the nastiest protein that you can currently consume. And the stuff I'm buying at a taco truck where it's $6 for a whole plate of nachos has to be the worst quality chicken I could buy and put in my body.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is why I hike.
Was it melted cheese or cheese sauce?
No sauce. Never a sauce.
Always
me.
A sauce. You know that, goddammit.
But you're a Texas, maybe, so you're probably
you got
a sauce
the queso head over here
well,
in the corner.
Yeah, actually, do you know where...
I'm a melting boy.
Well, what do you think? I mean, where did nachos start?
Mexico?
I mean, technically, yes, but a lot of people say San Antonio.
I didn't know that.
A proper nacho is not a plate. It's one really big chip that is like perfectly created by itself. So it has like
one chip with the cheese and then the pickled jalapeno on it.
So now, so the origin story is now contemporarily probably the deconstructed nacho.
Yeah.
Yeah, the original like, form
the original
of nacho.
Now what chefs would be like, this is a deconstructed single nacho, a perfect bite
but the
in
problem
every way.
With the problem with that is like when you get the traditional nacho in its purest form, when that arrives, like when you order nachos at a restaurant and they come out like that, everyone's like, oh, fuck. Like, nobody wants those. Like, even though they, like, somebody put a lot of time into this, like having them all laid out perfectly. But like... that's not something that I've ever really craved. I want a big old pile.
But here's the thing. Same. Like, if you go to Dallas or you go to San Antonio, you're like, I want nachos. You get a plate of nachos, but there's like six, and they're each for you. It's like so thoughtful and delicious.
No,
and it's like,
so you're not allowed to share
guys.
Them?
I mean, you could share them if you want, but like, why would you? Because they're like individual perfect bites.
But it's not a perfect bite if it's just cheese and jalapeno.
No, there's people mix it up. They add stuff to it that you could add a little salsa or like.
And is this queso? Is this cheese sauce or is this melted cheese?
No, it's melted. Ugh. Queso is a whole different thing.
That I understand. Yeah. I understand that being very specific,
queso's
especially
so good.
Anywhere in Texas. Queso is amazing.
But queso is for a dip, not for a drop, I say.
I'm out.
I mean,
I want my queso in a cup and I want the chip to go into it straight into my mouth. I don't want to have chips with the queso on top. all that queso. It's all soggy and shit. It's not good.
A good chip can withstand a good 15 minutes of cheese sauce.
I wish.
That's ridiculous to think that it's going to get soggy.
I haven't found a good chip like that in years.
Oh.
You got to come to Texas.
Yeah.
A good chip and a good man is hard to find in this fucking town. Do they have thick chips in Texas?
Yeah.
It's like real.
Yeah.
They make them out of old sopes.
That sounds like a strip club near the airport.
Thick chip.
Yeah. Give me thick a chips. Thick chip.
Yeah. I would go there.
It's like 2-for-1 Tuesdays at Thick Chips by the airport.
So I don't eat breakfast, so I have more room to eat my fourth meal.
Sure.
Yeah, I really need to stop doing that.
Oh, you're fine.
I mean, I'm fine, but
you don't do it very often. You do it once in a while, you're fine.
Yeah, I've just been... You know when you catch those food waves where, like, you eat so well for, like, 2 weeks, and you're like, I'm fucking killing it. I'm eating so much quinoa, and I wake up, and I feel great.
And then you go to Santa Fe for 5 days.
And then you have those 2 weeks where it's just every day, it's like, shouldn't have done that. Shouldn't have eaten that.
Sure.
Was that Santa Fe?
I mean, like...
Santa Fe wasn't that bad, but
And also when you travel a lot, just like, I guess I'm just going to eat this... Wolfgang Puck 2,000 calories Caesar salad at the JFK 5 terminal.
I also think
it's not good.
It kind of like it when it rains, it pours. Like sometimes you'll suddenly have like five people visiting you in a month, and they all you can't be like, we're gonna have brown rice and vegetables tonight. They're like in LA and they just
want
to rage.
I want Howl and Raise again.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like.
Tell me about this double-double. Yeah. Are those good?
You're just being like, oh, like no more visitors. I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
But also super fun. I mean, like, that's like...
It's tough being a food influencer, Andre. We get it.
I don't know what that is. But I do have friends that like to eat food.
Well, so I have a friend here who just, as of 2 days ago, pulled the, oh, I'm on the Whole 30. I can't actually like do anything this weekend. Do you have friends like that who are like, I can't eat, I can't drink, I can't go out?
That can be
you just
us.
Delete their number.
That can be us once in a while. I mean, I'll do something like a 21 day. You didn't drink for a month. It happens once in a while.
It happens once in a while, but like
try to clean out.
But
closet.
I feel like whenever I do, I never do a full thing. Like if I'm gonna do a Whole 30. Then I'll be like, but I'm definitely like drinking still through it or something. Or like,
so he just takes what
like
he wants,
half 30.
Leaves the rest.
Or like I'm not drinking for a month, so I'm going to like smoke a lot of pot. Sorry, mom. Or like something like that.
It's
you know, like
30.
You have to balance it out, or else you're just going to go crazy. Like, how will you even sleep at night without drugs or alcohol? You know what I mean?
Same. Or nachos. One of the three sleep groups, as I like to call them.
Yeah, we understand each
Science.
Other.
So how did you start working? How did you become the editor in chief of Munchies? Did you start off as in the mailroom and climb your way through to the top, or were you just instantly appointed the highest position at this company, at this vertical?
Yeah. So Munchies was a show on Vice.com for a couple years, and the two executive producers of that show, Lauren Cinnamon and Chris Grosso, realized that like it was one of the most successful video franchises at Vice. Mm-hmm. And Vice as a whole started to realize.
Call the vertical, please.
Well, at this point, it was not a vertical. So Vice realized like, oh, people are really into food in our audience. And so this was about 4.5 years ago. So Lauren and Chris came up with the idea to launch the food vertical. And nice. They were looking for someone to create the site, and they found me. So you've been
from the very beginning.
Yeah. So I kind of worked together with them, and we started with one website, and now we're in 10 countries internationally.
Wow.
So I oversee a lot of different... We have editors in each place. We're launching in Italy next month, so... Lots of pasta content.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I get what you're saying now. Yeah. It's specific language, specific country. Got it.
Who's the LA editor?
We don't have an LA editor anymore, actually. We are...
LA's dead, Jason.
The food scene here is fucking dead.
People are too healthy out here for us.
Javier did... He was a guest on this pod, actually.
Yes.
He was awesome.
No,
Javier
is
so
amazing,
cool.
And he has such an amazing palate and knows LA in a way that I feel like... No one else.
So then, why'd
does.
You fire him?
He's a great guy, and he's awesome.
He is awesome.
So, yeah, but we're essentially like, you know, we keep launching, and I think the challenge with Munchies in general, we're not like typical media outlets for food because we're not writing, you know, the best restaurant lists, or we're not... We have them.
I would yeah,
in the mix,
I mean,
but it's not our kind of bread and butter, if you will. We're really
I see what you're saying. I just meant like
on
not
content.
Doing some eater bullshit.
Like, I would I just like I'll be looking for something a little less than maybe. Never mind. Yeah.
Well,
the eater
right,
editor is going to be on next week.
Yeah.
So if you look at, you know, food media, I think there's so much great content. You have recipe content, you have useful city guides and things like that. And then there's a lot of culture stuff. And I think mm-hmm. everyone in the space is now doing a lot of culture stuff. Mm-hmm. But our challenge is always like, we are the world's first millennial food site. So meaning that we're, sorry, the global millennial food site. So mm-hmm. like basically everything that we publish, we constantly have to live in a world between local and international. So like, how does a story that might be local appeal to somebody in Dubai and vice versa?
You do it on acid.
Yeah.
If it's for Vice.
Mm-hmm.
That too.
Totally. Yeah.
That also.
We went to a coffee roasting village on acid and here's what happened.
Pretty much. But also, so broad, but also relevant.
Well, I mean, we're trying to tell stories about people through food, essentially. Right. And I think that's the thing, too, is like I've worked in food media for about 10 years. And when I started out, there were quote unquote blogs and there was traditional print media and nothing like the landscape that we're seeing now existed. And mm-hmm. I think what's been really exciting is that it used to be sort of the elders, people who are super knowledgeable and older skewing and had apprenticed for years and years and years. And now I think food is a platform for a lot of different voices and stories to tell beyond just restaurant stories.
Do you think it's oversaturated right now?
I feel
like it is a little bit.
I think food is definitely at its height. I think it's hit like pop culture status. I mean, you have celebrities doing food shows. You've got, you know,
fucking
Instagram influencers.
Do you think that there's going to be a food bubble that pops, or is it even something that could pop? Because people are just going to eat forever.
I don't know. I mean, I think what's really interesting is young people. Like, if you think about the Gen X kids, like they've grown up with the media landscape that is right now. So their language for food is so developed in a way that our palates aren't even developed because they're so young. Like, take a show like MasterChef Junior. Have you guys ever seen it?
Mm-hmm. No. I mean, but no.
I have seen
it.
Seen it.
For sure.
It's some of the darkest television on available
but
for viewing.
It's pretty crazy. Like, those kids are, like, there was a kid that won. I think her name was Madison or something. And she was probably 8 or 9 years old. And she's like, oh, I just sous vide this thing. Or, oh, I just made, like, a cow soy. Like, you're 8 years old and you know what cow soy is.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Just from her brain.
It's crazy.
So, I don't know. I mean, I think that will it
It's
pop?
Just mostly coconut milk. I don't know. I don't give a shit. But, no,
but
I'm totally kidding.
It's interesting that something that's so...
It's incredible. It's totally incredible.
Something that's so universally consumed, like food, has kind of taken longer to hit that point. Like, because you see it all the time with, like, sports, or, like, you see, like, here's, like, a 5-year-old who can do, like, a backflip on a skateboard. Like, you see stuff like that all the time. Or like a basketball player child who is just the new Michael Jordan, but you'd never really see it other than like Flynn, the child prodigy chef guy. Like, but now on MasterChef Junior, here's all these kids who are so good. But like, I wonder, are they actually good at cooking, or are they just some like nerdy little kids who know about this stuff? But do they actually have the ability to really know how to do it well and like have a developed enough palate?
I don't know.
Or
I mean,
like just
not...
Because there's so much experience that you have to have logged, you know, years of hard work logged to really turn into a master chef.
To do the high-end technical cooking that they're doing, probably, you know, like that part might suffer. But that kind of sincere interest and kind of rustic, more simpler, but very specific and attention paid to detail cooking at the same time, I think an 8-year-old could do it. Practice-wise, I mean, if they're allowed and kind of emboldened by their parents to be around heat and knives and not be scared of it and embrace it and be pay attention.
I guess that part's good.
I mean, like, Doogie Howser was a doctor by the time he was, like, 11.
That's a good point, actually.
So, but, I mean, can every kid do it? Can you put a kid of 30 kids in a class and be like, who's good at math? It's going to be fewer as far as, like, who's got a penchant for it, who does it well. But, like, yeah, I think you can get some prodigies for sure. And they migrate. They migrate to that TV show. It's not accidental.
Well, that's the thing that
like,
I'm
they're not picking kids off the street being like, all right, come on in. We're going to cook right now.
But I've met a couple of those, like, child chef people, and it's kind of weird. Like, you can tell, like, their only goal in life is to become, like, a famous food chef. But also, like, when you see, like, a little kid who's good at basketball, you can tell all they want to do is be in the NBA, but that's totally normal and fine.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, though. I think the celebrification of food. Like, that's the era that we live in.
Just gonna say it. Absolutely. 100%.
And I think, you know, like, I did an interview with Jacques Pepin, and we talked about, basically, like, his life advice for young chefs. And he's like, when I was...
Do it in a French accent, please.
Well, he started working at age 14, and he worked until age 20 as a chef, basically. Like, he moved up the ranks through this really amazing restaurant, and as he apprenticed and he finally moved to Paris and he worked in kitchens there, you know, he talked a lot about how the goal was for every single chef to cook exactly the same perfectly so that you could never tell whose it was. He was like, the nights that you could tell who had a signature on it was bad because that was not the point of that dining.
That's fascinating.
And so he was like, frankly, when I talk to young chefs now, I don't want to, you know, speak for him, but he kind of basically said, like, I feel bad for them in a way because there's so much pressure to kind of put their signature on it. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of the rise of the individual. And I think that's true of probably a lot of mediums, not just food. But I think that America is so obsessed with celebrity. It's like our greatest export at this point. You know, it's like the Kardashian culture. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, just a kid like who wants to open their own restaurant at 18, is that anything new? No. Like, go to France. They've been doing that for 100+ years. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a... People care a lot about being known instead of just being like, hey, I make good food. And I think that's tricky with restaurant culture because running a restaurant's really hard, and I think it's a long game, and I think being a celebrity chef, it's tricky, you know, as you keep going, but...
Well, I couldn't agree more. I'm so articulate, but also I feel like there's such a loss of respect for the food itself, and so much more about, like you said, being a celebrity, but also about the ego and the identity as opposed to what food is and what it does for us and how we eat it and how we share it. I mean, it's just like it becomes fashion, and it's like the furthest thing from what excites me about food, and it's so alienating part of that culture. And
that's why I have him on the podcast to balance me out.
Mr. Nachos over here.
No, but it is. It's that Kardashian element of show and just like,
look how I made this better than you guys with more dazzling ingredients and it looks better and I'm cool now.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely that. It's definitely like how alienating certain restaurant experiences can be basically detract the aspect of sharing and bringing people together. How hard it is to get into...
Like a vespertine?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like it's not... It becomes a different experience. And those experiences aren't mutually exclusive. It's just I gravitate to one a lot more strongly. I mean, I think food can be art in ways that it doesn't always have to necessarily be the thing you're going to eat before you die, the last thing you want. But it can be an experience that's really incredible and interesting and thoughtful. But those... They're just different experiences, and yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's not.
But it's good. But it really is why I like to have you on here, because I need this balance, because I'm like, I definitely fall victim into being the, you know, the Kardashian-ass world of food.
Once in a while.
But you know, But I'm aware of that, and I know that I need rustic Andre over here to bring me back down to earth.
Yeah.
And then you need me to just give you a little booster and get those. He doesn't have social media. He's not on Instagram. He's not on Twitter. Anything like that.
That's true.
And then I'm on it a little too much. So it's kind of like it's a good combo. He's the yin to my yang.
A little Mutt and Jeff over here.
It's good. We should talk about this book that you're on your worldwide press tour. Of course, you had to hit
everywhere. First stop on the world tour.
The book's Late Night Meals from the World's Best Chefs.
Yeah, yeah, you got it.
And Munchies has put out books before, books. This is the first book.
No, this is our first book ever, yeah. So basically, it's a culmination of the show that launched the website. And we ended up retitling Munchies to Chef's Night Out. So the show was retitled, and then we took that name and made it our site. So,
oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, which I think a lot of people, it's pretty funny. We still have a lot of cooks that like I'll run into or just random people that I meet when I'm traveling who are like, oh my God, I love Munchies. And I'm like, oh, cool, thanks. And then I realize, oh, you're just talking about the show.
Talking about Chef's Night Out.
Right, right.
Because they subscribe to like the YouTube player and they, you know, kind of watch that. But basically we have over 200 episodes at this point. We filmed all
over the
world.
I was on one of them.
I know.
That's incredible.
We should talk about it.
Okay, let's talk about it.
But this book's pretty amazing. I mean, there are over 65 chefs in it. There's actually like more along the lines of 80 if you really counted it up.
How many recipes are in it?
There are 65 recipes. So, but there's also a lot of
chill.
It's pretty chill. you know, that's how we're marketing this book, is pretty chill.
It's a chill amount of recipes.
Yeah.
Like, I'm slowly trying to write a cookbook right now, and it seems like a very daunting thing, but when I see 65, I'm like, that's not that bad.
It's definitely
a lot.
But,
I mean,
that's a low
amount of recipes compared to most cookbooks, though.
No, it's pretty standard, but it's not just recipes. We also have things like how to drink mezcal with Enrique Olvera, or we have... you know, how to
drink vodka like the Russians.
Look, exactly. the first thing in the book is how to make your own Fernet. Take my money.
Yeah.
Like, it's so great. I love that it opens with like how to bootleg your own alcohol.
I love that too, but then I was like, I didn't want Fernet to be this easy to make.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like, it's like any recipe.
But
right?
but it's
how
like,
I find it is. But it's so, it's just, it was a fun way to open the book.
It's a daytime to learn, a lifetime to master.
Sure.
Fernettery.
It's Fernettery. But also, I really love how the table of contents is organized, like how you divided all the sections. It's one of the most, and I like cookbooks. I'm someone who likes to cook from cookbooks. Not everyone's like that. He's not like that.
Well, we tried to engineer it in a way where it's basically like the show. Like, it starts out very tame, and then by the end of it, it's just like,
really bend
good
you
luck.
Over.
You've probably called somebody to like bail you out of jail.
Yes.
Or you're in an alleyway, or you're next to like the nacho truck. And either way,
you're washing the vomit out of your hair.
You know, there are recipes that are pretty much late night food that you, during the daylight, might look at yourself and judge yourself a little bit. But then there's also really amazing recipes that you could make at dinner parties. Like, we have this incredible Dungeness crab with black bean and butter sauce from Keo. And we actually started the book with Fernet because that is the alcohol that people drank the most on the show. Mm-hmm. And it's come up.
It's a real chef's booze.
It literally is.
And
a
bartender's booze. It's just like it's that food and drink industry.
It made
food and
me,
beverage industry.
I was not happy to learn how much sugar goes into Fernet.
So true Fernet is much more complicated than what we created.
Yes.
The recipe that we have is from Sam Anderson, who is the beverage director at Mission Chinese Food. And he's kind of just, if you haven't had his cocktails, they're pretty masterful and amazing. And he created this recipe with us that basically you could pull anything from your garden and you basically steep it for 6 weeks. And then you add a bunch of crazy stuff to it if you want. But the nice thing is you can build off of that. You can like customize it and make it your own. But I think one of my favorite cocktails in the book is actually, it's from Joe Beef. It is called
Love Joe Beef.
The Rene Angelil. May he rest in peace. That's not the title. It's just Renee Angelil.
Sure.
But basically, it's a cocktail that's dedicated to Renee, you know? So there's
for
a lot of fun
at
stuff.
Home, could you explain who that is?
Renee Angelil is the now deceased husband of Celine Dion.
Oh, that's right. I was like, is that the name of like a legendary French chef who I've never heard of before, and now I feel like an idiot? But no.
It sounds like it, right?
It's the guy. It was like the really rich guy, kind of balding gray. He's mm-hmm. no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
He supported her during those golden years.
That's right.
What's
the balding
cocktail?
Gray guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
R.I.P.
Yeah, it's a combination of things.
That's my favorite kind of cocktail.
It's the kind that you're going to have late at night.
You're going to have to buy the book if you want to know how to
make it. Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what's in it because it's so good you need to bring it to the karaoke bar and sing My Heart Will Go On.
Dang.
What's your karaoke song, your go-to?
Depends on the vibe. I have a theory that, I don't know about you
Coke
guys.
Coke or no Coke?
When you go into a karaoke space with people that you know or you don't know, mm-hmm. everyone's super awkward because they're probably not drunk yet. Mm-hmm. So you have mm-hmm. to start them off. You got to warm them up. So I start with Backstreet Boys or something that mm-hmm. everyone knows mm-hmm. or Spice Girls. Mm-hmm. You build that up. And then when 2 or 3 hours pass, it's Shania Twain, Any Man Ooh. Of Mine.
Oh, you know, like a Twain karaoke.
I don't hear this very often, but I heard it a little while ago. That was a real fun fire starter. Bon Jovi, Young Guns theme song.
Oh.
Ooh.
I was just thinking about Young Guns.
Sure.
And speaking of fire starter, our friend Dan, who got married this weekend, that was the song was Prodigy Firestarter that played when the bride and groom were revealed at the reception.
Yeah, First Dance Firestarter.
That's pretty great.
Oh, God.
Wait, so what is your karaoke song?
I don't really sing karaoke that much, but it's usually Solitary Man.
Well,
I've done a couple times. Who is that?
Neil Diamond?
Neil Diamond? Yeah, Neil Diamond.
That's a good one.
Because I'm not a very good singer, so it's like a song that you can kind of talk through, and then you can kind of like slowly croon it up a little bit, you know?
I've seen him do Don't Stop Believin'.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. I mean, anything by Journey, but also like...
That one's a little Yoki 101.
Sure.
I don't think you should sound good when you're singing karaoke. It's not American Idol.
I think you should. You don't have to nail it. But if you sound like shit, that's one of my biggest pet peeves. Is if you are a horrible karaokeer, or if you choose a rap song, and you don't know the words by heart, it never works out. Because like it's going really fast, and then you just like
that's fair.
Whenever that happens, I just want to unplug the karaoke machine. It's for some reason it makes me so uncomfortable. It's a food podcast.
Don't do karaoke in Nashville if that's how you feel.
The thong song. Don't do it.
Well, I said songs that you don't know by heart.
Yeah.
And that one obviously is mm-hmm. locked in up top. So, when is the book for sale, or is it already available?
So you can pre-order it right now, but it comes out October 24th. It's on 10 Speed Press. And yeah, I mean, we have chefs literally from all over the world. We have people from Japan, Denmark, the UK, Mexico, Canada.
So this cookbook is like a nice compilation album where you just, all the hits. You just have other people do all the work for you. You put it all together, put the Munchie's name on it. We're
not
laughing
quite.
All the way to the bank.
10 Speed.
You know, print media is just killing it so much lately. You're going to get fucking rich.
10 Speed is the cool cookbook press, right? I mean, like, everything cool.
Did they do the squirrel one?
Mm-hmm. I think they did Koreatown. They did, there's a bunch.
They do, they're really amazing because they allow us to be so creative, and I think we're such a weird crew of, I call it like the scrappy ones who are sort of like the dumpster divers of their publications,
right.
Where they come
sure.
in and they're like, should we have let them write a cookbook? I don't know. but they let us do that, and I think, you know, this cookbook is a...
Do you guys keep stealing the toilet paper in the bathroom when you come in for meetings?
Like, do you live somewhere? Yeah, no, I mean, they allowed us, I think a great example, we have a recipe from Daniel Patterson in the cookbook, and it's actually the only recipe that has vegetables in it.
That's amazing.
Because all these are literally the meals that they, at the end of every episode, they go back to their restaurant and they cook. And for anyone who hasn't seen the show, you should go check it out and watch the Louis Tikram episode, which you were featured on. And I want to talk about the sticky rice incident in one moment, but
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But, you know, rather than just, I think, glorifying these chefs, because these are literally like the greatest chefs in the world. You have, you know, everyone from Christina Tosi to...
Wiley Dufresne,
Anthony Bourdain, Danny Bowen, Dominique Crenn, David Chang, April Blumenfeld, goes on and on and on. We tried to capture their personalities or like the moments that our audience responded to. So in the case of Daniel Patterson, he decided on his episode, because we basically say to people like, hey, where do you want to go for the night? And we pay for it. So he took his wife out on a really nice date for the whole episode. And I think what's so funny about our audience is that not only do we have a food audience, but we also have a vice audience, people who don't necessarily know who the key players are in food. So if we went through
the
all
comment section of the Patterson one must be a real funny one.
Well, we actually put excerpts from the comments into it.
Oh, good.
To sort of talk about, like...
Because usually, like, the point of the show... Like, I've seen many episodes, and it's usually, like, every time you try to kind of outdo everyone else, like, we party the most, we're going to have the craziest night, we're going to make the best food, we're going to eat the wildest, gluttonous things, and you try to outdo each other, and then Patterson comes around and takes his wife out for a nice date, and then, like...
Yeah, sometimes I think missing is like Johnny Knoxville.
Huckleberry arugula for my late night munchie.
But it's a really good recipe. I mean, it tastes so delicious. It's a kind of essentially like a vegetable stir fry with bulgur, and you can put
I saw that actually.
Sunny side up egg on it. It's great for breakfast or lunch. But
when I come home from the club, I'm like, oh, I want some fucking bulgur so bad.
Yeah, definitely late night food.
Didn't he do the recipe of the boiled scrambled eggs too? I think it was on, it was on like Chef's Table or Mind of a Chef, I think it was just recently in like the New York Times magazine, like last Sunday, of like his recipe for boiled scrambled eggs, which is, I don't think anybody wants to eat, but it's like, you like get a pot of boiling water. And you stir it like a whirlpool effect, and then you pour the scrambled eggs into it, and then it floats on top and slowly, not even slowly, like quickly just turns into just scrambled eggs. And then you pull it off and then garnish it with whatever you want. Seems interesting. It seems like something I'd like to try. I don't know if it's...
It sounds like something I want to watch you make and then not try it.
Well, I mean, we do have some egg recipes in this book.
Sure.
But I think one of my favorite recipes is from Jamie Bissonette from Toro. And he, you know, for anyone who hasn't been to Toro, it's Spanish inspired. And the recipe is really simple. And it's basically, it starts with for a bad hangover. And then there's another section that's like for a really bad hangover. And what you do is get a bag of your favorite potato chips and you get scrambled eggs. And it's genius because it's essentially a play on like
Frito
a Spanish
pie.
Tortilla.
Sure.
Spanish tortilla and a Frito pie.
Tortilla Espanol.
Yeah, you could...
Oh, shit, I didn't even think about the Spanish tortilla. Yeah, you just get like a bag of Lay's, cut it open like a Frito pie thingy, and you just dump scrambled eggs and hot sauce, I guess.
Yeah, and you like mix it together. And
have you eaten this before?
Yeah, it's so delicious. It's really good.
This is incredible. Because a tortilla de espanol is like, you do the onions and the potatoes, and you're basically making...
It's delicious.
Kind of, yeah, it's great. But,
what's better than potatoes?
Potato that is chips. Some Spanish hood food right there. Just
it's
getting the
so good
the from the slums chips. Of Barcelona.
Yeah, seriously, that's so cool. I love it.
But I think that's the thing. It's like all these recipes are more storytelling of who these people are. It's not about like fancy things. Mm-hmm. Like Dominique Crenn literally was like, my favorite comfort food is grilled cheese, and so she kind of took it to the next level and went to her cheesemonger. And so her recipe is all about like how you actually should talk to a cheesemonger and like what the cheeses are that you should...
It had better be.
put in that bread.
Because you can't just have a recipe on how to make grilled cheese.
Maybe you can.
We need more than that nowadays. Everybody knows how to make a damn grilled cheese.
But not with fancy she's got, cheeses.
So it's like the way to have the best grilled cheese is just like be really rich and then buy like really expensive cheese and like really expensive bread and really expensive butter, and it's going to be so good.
I'm trying to think of how many cultural recipes there are for like bags of chips, like Frito Pie, Toasty Locos. Now there's this new Spanish one being introduced. And what also, are the ones I don't know about?
But the scrambled eggs with the potato chips, that also reminds me of like the matzo brie, where you like chop up the matzo crackers and mix it with the scrambled eggs.
Right.
So this has been going on.
It's a beautiful marriage.
It's been going on for a while now, and now I instantly want to have scrambled eggs with chips, because also in the cookbook, it was just a bag of Lay's. The lowest common denominator potato chip, but there's so many good ass chips out there.
Yeah, I mean,
I know what
you're
thinking of. You're thinking Rusty's.
I'm thinking Rusty's, but also like, what if like a salt and vinegar potato chip?
Sure.
What's that going to do to your mouth?
Yeah. What are those? The Haba chips.
Have a corn chip.
That would be delightful. Oh. I mean, do you?
But that's a tortilla. You know? That changes everything. Hey, a corn chip is a lot different than a tater.
If you want to do it with Doritos, we're not going to be mad about it. It's your world.
I may have eaten Doritos last night.
God damn it.
In addition to my nachos.
Yeah, double up on those corn chips. Have you had, visiting from New York, have you had Rusty's either potato chips or corn chips?
I think so.
They're similar to the Have a Corn
Chip.
They're
very similar to Have a Chips, but they're made, in Long Beach? Or they're made Southern California.
Yeah, they're in Huntington Beach, man.
Huntington Beach. But they're,
they make potato chips, but they look just like the Have a Corn chips, like a clear bag, like kind of like surfer.
With like a surfboard on
surfer
it?
Surfer ass.
Yes. Yeah, I've had those.
But I think those potato chips might be.
Those are both our favorites of all time.
Delightful.
I just don't know how far they're getting out. I'm sure, I mean.
We're getting there.
They're blowing up, but I don't know if it made that other coast.
Shout out to those guys.
Shout out to fucking Rusty's.
Yes. Yeah.
There's a recipe in there in the book for a bologna and raclette sandwich.
Yes.
I feel like bologna is kind of, it's trending right now. Do you agree?
So, have you ever?
it is. No, I mean, like, bologna obviously has existed for forever, but it was always, like, I never grew up eating bologna. Like, you would see it on TV and, like, we're going to have a bologna sandwich. Or, like, every once in a while, I'd go to a friend's house and like their mom would make a bologna sandwich. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, that's just not what I was expecting.
I'm
you
from
to
LA.
Ask me.
I eat damn turkey sandwiches, boy. But I've seen like the Bon Appetit like best restaurant list. Like one spot does like their own house made bologna sandwich with like potato chips on it, and then this book has a bologna like artisanal house cured bolognese. I feel like are like emerging as a trending cured meat vertical. What say you?
So have you been to Nashville?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you know, or I hope you've had a fried bologna sandwich because that's like their classic thing. So Catbird Seat, which is in Nashville. Eric Anderson, who used to be the chef de cuisine there, basically drank more Fernet than anyone has ever consumed on Chef's Night Out, to the point where the next day, it was a rough taping the next day when he did his interview, and he was just like, I feel very ill. But he made this smoked bologna sandwich, and it was sort of a tribute to that sandwich, to the Nashville version. So he actually literally got a normal log, if you will, of bologna and smoked it.
So he bought the whole bologna log.
Yeah. Why mess with a beautiful, perfect thing? And the key to it was that he put it in a barbecue smoker, and then he used raclette to make like a really delicious cheese sauce. Mm-hmm. So.
And then cut it thick.
Cut it real thick.
So it's like a bologna steak and not like a thin flap.
Yeah, it's going to get fried.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. You could fry it or you could leave it as is. And that's kind of the thing with all the recipes too. It's like you can take it and do whatever
you want.
It's
already fat, but you can make it fattier depending on how drunk you are.
It's so delicious.
but I mean, mark my words, bologna is going to be very, for the rest of the year, it's I feel it happening.
But don't you think to a degree, I feel like Oscar Mayer has done a disservice to bologna. Like, it's just mortadella, just made with less, or to an extent.
Yeah, I don't even know. What makes bologna, you know?
I mean, I don't know. I feel like there's a history of those kind of mixed.
You've made bologna from scratch, right? How do you do
every
it?
Every day. I do it every day before I go to work.
You do your daily
bologna. That's how I start my day.
Skip
I wake
breakfast.
Up at 6, I do a hike, and then I like to make bologna.
I make my bologna for the day.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think meat in a tube in general is great. Like, the bad stuff, the good stuff,
Agreed.
It's all great. You know what I mean? It's great.
I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. You also, the opposite of bologna sandwich, there's the caviar and butter sandwich.
Yeah.
Which...
Emwell's Steakhouse. Yeah.
That one's fucked up, man.
Yeah.
But it reminds me of the Grand Central Oyster caviar and creme fraiche sandwich. And
yes.
I feel like I'd like to do a head... Because the sandwich in the book where it's basically like, get two pieces of bread and then get like really, really good cultured butter and then have like a quarter inch thick layer of butter mm-hmm. across all surfaces of the bread and then you just dump a bunch of caviar on it and eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds a spatula, probably.
Which sounds amazing.
Yes.
But then like... But the Grand Central one has creme fraiche instead of the butter and I feel like... I'd be very curious to see like a head-to-head test. What would be better?
Yeah.
What say you?
Well, interesting connection. So Hugues Dufour from M. Wells, on his episode,
say that name again?
So the chef, Hugues, who is French-Canadian, he and his wife, Sarah.
He's married with that name?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Anything's possible.
They went to Grand Central Oyster Bar on their episode and actually had like an oyster feast. And then they went back to M. Wells' dinette at the time.
Interesting.
So they built this beautiful caviar sort of ice display. So they got this gigantic ice block. And
just a super chill caviar.
Something you can do at home.
Hashtag chill. That's what this book is chill. Yeah. But they basically had this over-the-top, very French-Canadian in a way, because I feel like that's the thing about French-Canadians. Like,
the Joe Beef guys really go real over-the-top with that stuff.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
How are they, any of those guys alive, you know?
Well, they're the New Orleanians of the North. Like, they know how to live well, you know?
Oh.
It's very rich, beautiful food. But that recipe is great, I think, because, yeah, it's just so simple, but... The way that it's written, it's Hugues writing about it, and it's pretty funny. And caviar's the best. You know, if you got access to it, go eat
Seriously.
Some.
I mean,
don't.
I like if you've got access to it. If you have access to a Lamborghini, do drive that car. It's a great one.
I mean, I used to be a truffle dealer, and I sold caviar for years. And
really?
You ever get high on your own supply?
Of caviar, yeah, absolutely.
Ever pinch a little cav on the way
Definitely.
To your drop-off?
Yeah.
any of those guys go missing? Those truffles, like, ooh.
You had that little ivory caviar Coke spoon?
I mean...
Package a little light this week.
A little light? The tin's a little light today. You know something about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I took it and I ate it.
Yeah. No, we actually did eat truffles when they were broken.
That's awesome.
You get the factory defects?
Yeah.
What do you do? What's your ideal truffle scenario?
Well, it depends on what kind of truffle you're talking about. I really like white truffles.
Baller answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's my fave. And
yeah.
I like to eat them in a couple different ways.
What's that white truffle is going for, like 400 an ounce? What is it?
So every year... I think people hear truffles and they're like, oh, it's so expensive and it's a complete bullshit industry. But the reason it's so expensive is because you can't replicate it. So like black truffles, you can actually go to a truffier, which is a farm, and you can try to inoculate them and recreate them.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had some success there. But with white truffles, you really can't. And
they have to be foraged naturally.
Yeah. So it's kind of one of the last wild foods. That's super unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really great, really simply. Like, if you put it in chicken broth, I think that's the best way to experience it because it brings out all the aroma.
Mm-hmm. No, it's exciting.
So
look at my face, it's exciting.
So you just get a chicken broth, you put a little white truffle in there, and it steeps and flavors the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, you would have, like, a tortellini and brodo or something along those lines. But
I've really been thinking a lot about tortellini and brodo lately, actually.
In this weather?
I really want to try and make it because I feel like when it's done correctly, when it's done perfectly, I don't know if there's a better thing to eat.
I agree 1,000%.
Like holy, it's like insane. And it's just like a bowl with like chicken broth and tortellini with some like ricotta and a little Parmesan or something like that. Like, it's so simple, but when it's nailed perfectly, it's so crazy. But,
yeah.
And it doesn't seem like it's that hard to do, but it obviously is.
Sure.
I want to try. Have you ever made it before?
No, I've tried making pasta. I'm really bad at it.
It's fucking hard.
I leave it to the pros, but yeah.
Speaking of leave it to the pros, you have a section in your hardcore section of your cookbook, which I assume means like the difficulty level has been increased and like the gluttonous aspects have been increased.
It's more just that Chris Grosso, one of our executive producers, we were talking about it, and he's like, it's just that time in the night on the show Chef's Night Out when everyone is basically blasé drunk or getting there.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
And and you know, you're about to get into some hardcore stuff. You want poutine, you want pizza, you want kind of that dirty,
yes,
delicious.
Well, speaking of leaving pasta to the pros, you have a pizza making tutorial in the hardcore section.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is one of the biggest leave it to the pro foods out there. Unless you have, like, we've cooked with the Rockbox pizza. Have you seen that? It's like the at home pizza oven. It gets to 900 degrees. That way you can actually make pizza that's worth eating at
home. Kind of impressive.
But I feel like making pizza at home, it's very hard to have it be even passable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's always fucked up.
You're limited by equipment. It's one of those cuisines that you are 100% limited by the tools that you have for sure.
Yeah, but you know, there's ways to adapt that, and that's why
that's what I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, sheet pans, cast iron skillets, like, you know, there's different styles, but I think that's the thing. Like, when we combed through every single recipe from the show that's ever been made, there were kind of two big categories. It was like meat. And the subsection of that was like offal, essentially. Mm-hmm. It was like every animal part ever.
A lot of tongue in this book, I will say.
Nah.
A little tripe, a little tongue.
There's like three things. There's beef heart, tripe, and tongue. But yeah, we really tailored it down. But it was that, and then it was pizza. It was like pizza or tacos. And I think, you know, the pizza recipes, they're all from different chefs, and they're their styles of how they like to do it. But ultimately, you can take the base dough, which is from Frank Pinello, a best pizza, and you can riff on it how you want. So I think that's the thing. It's like everything is manageable in a way that you can like make it your own, as opposed to being like, well, this is the way that Pauly G does it, and I have to do it exactly that way.
Right.
It's like, well, this is the way he tops his pizza. So yeah, there's just too many people, and we didn't want to like leave people out. It was so hard to figure out who to put in and why. But yeah, so we got a lot of pizza.
It's also, I mean, it's kind of like a blank canvas, right? It reflects personalities in ways that tacos do too. But I mean, I think pizza really, to an
pizza
extent,
really
gives
tells
people
a lot about somebody when they whenever you go to somebody's house and they're doing like, we're having a pizza making party, and you see somebody make like the worst, shittiest pizza, and you're like, oh my God, I can never even look at you the same way. Like, what? You have no restraint at all.
For the audience, that's Jason talking.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Jesus.
Are you talking about yourself? Or?
We've all seen it.
Vicious.
You've seen somebody making pizza at the pizza party, and like, wow, that's how much sauce you're going to use? Wow, okay. You've never seen anything before on any. And then just like, wow, that's a lot of squash blossoms. Fine. I mean, you're obviously going to have a just
you know, it comes down to basically pizza. Jason's just happy to be there. You know, that's really what it is. He's just happy to be there. Everybody's welcome. No bad ideas.
But like,
I think is like what he's saying.
And at a pizza making party, there's like a slight air of competition going around. Like, who's going to make the best
there's
one?
There's a slight air of competition to any room you walk in personally for yourself. He's a very competitive little guy.
That is true. I am very competitive. I'm very little.
Like, you know, there's a slight air. Everybody has like got kids. They're hanging out and laughing. And Jason's like, all right, bitches. I see this.
You call that a... Wow. Okay.
Wow. How old's your kid?
But you want somebody to be in the room to have like a, you know, have a little concept of what's going on when it comes to pizza making. You don't want the competition to be just completely trash, you know?
Sure.
You want a healthy head to head.
You like that.
That's why I hang out with Andre, because he gives me a you know, he knows what he's doing. It's like when you play tennis against somebody who sucks at tennis, it's no fun.
He's only played tennis with me once.
Exactly.
How did it go? Not good?
I did not get invited back.
Oh.
He's not good enough. But he's good enough in the kitchen.
All right, baby. I'll take it.
The tennis court of life.
That's right.
You also have a carbonara recipe.
Yes.
Which is a very hot topic in terms of authenticity. And it's called a late night carbonara. Mm-hmm. And I assume, does the late night mean it's okay to add cream?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's from Michael White. And I think it is for that.
Can you explain who Michael White is to our listeners who don't know?
So Chef Michael White is an amazing chef based in New York. He owns a bunch of restaurants. You might know him from Marea, which is an amazing seafood and pasta restaurant. And, I mean, he's a guy from Wisconsin, and he's become this masterful kind of pasta genius.
Is that why it's okay for him to put cream in a carbonara, because he's from Wisconsin?
I mean, look, again, it's late at night. You want that carbonara. You want it to taste good. Why? Because Jason over here is going to watch The Hills late at night alone.
That's right.
With a bowl of this carbonara. And he doesn't want anyone to see him eating the carbonara with cream in it or Lauren Conrad on the screen, but it doesn't matter.
More of a Whitney fan, personally.
Okay, well, Whitney and you have that secret together, and the secret is that it's a delicious recipe, and it was really easy to make.
This is why you get the big bucks on, I gotta say. That was the answer.
The most fire answer.
That was the exact answer I was looking for.
We did an episode of this podcast once with a friend, Dave Chang, who basically... Dave Cho. And I think we talked for 45 minutes about carbonara, which is why...
Yep. Yeah,
he's a friend of mine who has a very strong opinion about, and a lot of people do, like a lot of people consider carbonara with cream to be one of the most sacrilegious things of all time.
It's just a dish. I couldn't be more with you on it. It's just a dish, but if you want, like, it's like defying something or just,
look, Mitch Orr, who's an Australian chef, wrote an op-ed for us that was this inflammatory, like, stop putting cream in your carbonara. Mm-hmm. It was a huge viral hit, and it was sort of exactly what we're talking about. But ultimately, with food, it's like no one owns food, you know? And I think that's the thing. It's like, if you want to put some cream up in there, do you, you know?
It's not going to taste bad.
I'm not going to stop you. Yeah. Or it might, and you can secretly judge everyone in the room, Jason, because you probably will. But, you know, it's like, whatever.
But now, all I want to do tonight is watch The Hills with a bowl of carbonara, just Indian style, on the floor in the middle of my living room. That sounds very good.
Right? I'm here to make...
You're painting a picture.
Your dreams come true at night with recipes.
I can picture this so vividly, him doing it at night with recipes.
Through this cookbook. Yeah.
You also... one thing that was really... really interesting to me was the fried chicken, fried rice. Mm-hmm. Because Andre, he's on a big fried rice kick in the last couple of months. He's got a nice wok ring on his stove.
Oh, nice.
So he has the ability to actually like make a decent fried rice at home in a proper wok. But I've never seen fried rice with fried chicken as the protein.
It's a genius idea.
And it seems like a great idea.
Yeah.
Well, it's also good because, like, if you have leftovers, it's like you could make the fried chicken from Charlie Bird, which is also in the book. Mm-hmm. And that recipe is super dank. It's a fennel-dusted fried chicken.
Yes.
With crushed red pepper flakes. I know, you can laugh.
I'm not laughing. I'm saying
this one over here
that
with the eye rolls.
No, I'm from Orange County. When I hear the word "super dank" to describe a fennel encrusted fried chicken, you're hitting all of my marks.
We say dank a lot.
You couldn't have been speaking my language anymore. I was just a little flabbergasted to hear it.
The fennel pollen. I know. I get it.
100% dank titty.
It's not the fennel. It's the dank. But like Kispaka, one of our favorite restaurants, they have the fennel pollen dusted pork chop. That's fucking crazy.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean fennel pollen.
Does your Jill, if you're listening, if you want to go to Kispaka this weekend, just talk to me.
We went. We can go again.
I just want to go as much as possible. That's a side tangent. So this is one thing I'm definitely going to make, because I love making fried rice, but I never make fried chicken at home just because I don't want my kitchen to get all splattered with the oil.
Well, it also makes sense considering that you made a rice stick on an episode of Chef's Night Out.
Just a big old rice stick.
Mm-hmm. I crafted mm-hmm. a rice stick.
Yeah, it was very...
Sculpted?
Sculptural.
I mean...
It was.
They opened up with it, right?
I'm glad it did not hit the editing room floor.
It was a tone setter.
So if no one knows what we're talking about, Jason here was on a Chef's Night Out episode with Louis Tikram, and that's actually the video opener, is you creating...
I just stopped being hungover from that episode yesterday.
That makes sense. It takes about 2 years to sort of get it out of your system. So
I just ate at EPLP 2 days ago with good old Louis.
Yeah, did you recreate that sculpture?
No, there was no. I ate some rice, but it wasn't sticky. But I've never I've never used sticky rice as like an art medium, and it really works well. Like it holds its shape a lot better than I thought, and you're able to achieve details that you wouldn't imagine before.
It's a vessel for innovation.
Jason becomes a prankster with a little booze in the restaurant. Starts kind of like trying to dunk things in other people's bowls. Starts getting sassy with people working there. He gets
I act out.
He can get on a roll.
Wait, so tell us about your experience having been on the show as someone who literally went through the experience. What was it like for you?
Well, I've talked about it on the show before, but I mean, it's like my ideal, like dream scenario. Like all I want to do is go to a restaurant where everything is free and the people that work there are like very eager to give you the best things that they have to offer. Like, oh, here's this, like when we went to Alimento, we had this magnum of wine that I thought was so good. But it would have never come out if they didn't want to like impress us for the camera. So that's like an amazing thing. And then now they have it at Cosa Buona. And whenever I go in there, I'm like, that's the one, that's the one.
Do you like their mozzarella sticks?
Of course.
Yeah.
It was so good.
We do, at the end of this, we're going to do a favorite thing we ate this week. And I think our last episode, that was your favorite thing that you ate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Cosa Buona mozzarella stick.
I forgot to prepare the best thing that I ate all week.
I'll just go through your Instagram while I'm doing mine. It'll be fine.
I forgot to tell you that we also do that. But I actually wanted to do like a separate, like a side tangent on the best thing that we ate.
Okay.
But it was inspired by a listener who was talking to me about it. And we were talking about, instead of the best thing that we ate all week, maybe to describe our ideal perfect bite of something.
Hmm. Ooh.
Which is a really tough, you know, you might need months to prepare that.
Sure.
I'm like, well, for me it was a salted almond with watered down Starbucks coffee on my flight this morning.
Hell yeah. Now we're talking.
The way those luxury. Two play off of each other on your palate, mm-hmm. on and off your palate.
Mm-hmm.
Almonds are big this year. So is watered down Starbucks
okay,
coffee.
Thank you, because I was...
thinking
it's the next
same
food
thing.
Trend. Yeah.
So, you know, just put that in the back of your mind. There's a couple, but the thing that looked the most appetizing to me in the cookbook was the Fernet gingerbread, like the little mini, like it looked like a dark wheat thin with the foie gras torchon on top of it. That I feel like that is probably going to be my favorite bite out of that book.
It's pretty extraordinary.
Unless it tastes like shit, what do you think?
No, no, no. It's actually one of the coolest recipes. So Maya Erickson, who used to be at Lazy Bear in San Francisco, she now, I think, is in Portland, but she sort of combined savory and sweet. Mm-hmm. So it's a foie gras torchon with a Fernet gingerbread.
What exactly is a torchon?
Well, it is...
Because I don't know.
Essentially like a whipped foie. Mm-hmm. And you serve it cold over this gingerbread. And when
in the
you,
80s, they called it a mousse. Just kidding.
Not.
Just kidding.
But when you put, like, the flavors of this specific recipe are pretty crazy. Because it's sort of one of those things where you take a first bite and you're like, what is going on? And then you keep eating it because mm-hmm. you're trying to figure it out. And, I don't know, it works really well.
I love that.
And I think, yeah, it's... It's also like again, the bloodline of this book is Fernet in a lot of ways. And I think that's what's super cool is sort of how it's true of who these people are as well. Like, San Francisco especially is like Fernet capital of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, they drink more Fernet than anywhere else. And yeah, I don't know. It's a nice way to like end the book too.
Italy's like, we'll keep making it, I guess. But Jesus, guys, really? You know, yeah. We invented
it
here.
Why did it become such a chef's drink?
I don't know. When I was bartending in college, I mean, I grew up, like, I would get a little bit of Fernet with water if I had an upset stomach as a kid, but I came from a big Italian family, and Fernet was always in it.
Bravo.
And then, you know, I go to college, and everybody's drinking, like, Jaeger, tequila, whatever, and then I started bartending and waiting, and then I was like, oh, other people drink it than Italians. Everybody who works in this restaurant and all the bartenders, like, they have shots of Fernet with beers, not shots of whiskey, or they just drink Fernet with soda water while they're, like, it's just like it was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It also just like, it's such a weird drink. I feel like when you first drink it, you're like, this is disgusting. And it tastes like something that you stole from your grandparents' liquor cabinet.
Is it safe to call it the Vegemite of the bar?
Maybe.
It's a very, it's a very polarizing flavor, isn't
it? My dad's going to have something to say to you, buddy, next time you guys go out.
But I don't like, once you have two or three glasses of it, it's really, I don't know, it makes you feel good.
It does make you
feel like
good.
You can stay up all night. You
there's a
helps
buzz.
Your stomach, you know,
are
you
we
can
still
digest.
Talking about, are we still talking about tonight?
I think, but also people.
It makes me feel like I want to dance.
People talk about different kinds of. We should open a bar together. All our friends will come.
It's gonna be fucking.
But yeah, people talk about different kind of like buzzes from alcohol, and I think there's degrees of it. But I think Fernet's the one where it's like, this is different than the others. And a lot of, I think, you know, like Jägermeister, I guess you kind of put in herbals, but Fernet to me also is.
Well, I can drink Fernet all night and feel okay-ish.
Yeah.
But if I drink like one Jaeger shot, I feel like I want to. Fling my body
off
a cliff.
I've been saying like when you go into the herbals, it's like that's where things kind of change.
The Fernet is like the double double, and Jägermeister is like a Burger King Whopper.
Can I ask? Are you referring to like a Tim Hortons double double or a?
What kind of double double
are you talking about?
We're not talking about Timmy's over here, babe.
In and out.
In and out only.
In and out.
Okay, I'm a Whataburger person, so I don't know about that.
Wait, what's a Tim Hortons double double?
So it, like, do you know what Tim Hortons is?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so
spent a lot of time
in
Canada.
We get a cup of Joe and a cruller in Saskatoon.
Yeah, literally. I actually had my first double double a couple months ago. Maddie Matheson, who is essentially the mayor of Toronto,
mm-hmm.
when I was in town, was like...
Have you ever heard of Drake? Just kidding.
He was like, you've never had a double-double? And I was like, no. And he was like, all right, I know what we're doing right now. And he drove me to a Tim Hortons. We got double-doubles and Boston cream donuts.
Mm-hmm.
Double-double is, I think, it's a coffee, but mm-hmm. it has two sugars, two creams.
Mm.
It is the sweetest thing that you will ever drink and makes you feel like you're going to be sick. But there's something about it that you're like, I'm going to keep drinking it.
Where's the plus side to this?
I don't know. I
could see it being a thing.
So it's like when you,
it's like
I get what you're saying.
Sure.
It's like when you go to Dunkin's and you order a light and sweet.
Yeah.
It's like the same kind of thing.
Yeah. You get a Parliament, you smoke it outside. It's
the
same
nice
experience.
Parliament?
Yeah.
We really are in Toronto.
This is great.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Toronto. Yeah.
Taking me back. Well, yeah, I don't. I drink my coffee black. On the weekend, I'll do a little cream and sugar in it if I'm feeling
really?
Real naughty. But, yeah, I'm not. That does not interest me at all, especially like a corporate chain restaurant's cream and sugar and coffee.
I think what's interesting, though, is like it's funny because, yeah, obviously out here, In-N-Out is like a double-double or what is it, animal style,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
You've had it before, right?
Yeah, I've had In-N-Out.
You like
it? Yeah, it's good.
But you're like Whataburger. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I grew
I'm
up on that.
For
like,
it.
That's
right.
Also, Whataburger, you know, is good.
Whataburger is good.
It's not McDonald's.
Yeah.
It's like,
no, it's,
Whataburger's good.
It's a sense of local pride, even though it's not, because it's a chain, you know?
Sure.
And I think mm-hmm. that's the same with
it's my Del
Tim
Taco.
Hortons. Yeah, yeah.
You get it.
I sure do.
We should go to Del Taco while you're in town.
Yeah.
Have you been to a Del Taco?
I don't think so. Will I get food poisoning?
No.
Maybe.
No.
Well, before we get to the best thing we had all week, Will, do you have any? I have one. I had one last question.
Well, I was going to say, the recipes are great, and I think you can. People will see them and really appreciate like the curation of all of it, and I think that to me was also really impressive. But I mean, you're pulling from so many incredible chefs, but reading Vitaly's intro to it was like this really sweet, wistful kind of like, oh, to be young. Because I think like he talks about...
That's why Vitaly's the best, man.
He is. He's incredible, but he wrote it so well that you kind of like, you're set up to hang out with the cool kids, which is what the book is, and that's what Vice is, and that's what Munchies is. I mean, it's like a brand that is very, it's very cool.
I feel like Vitaly should maybe, like, he should, like, start writing his own cookbooks because he's such a good writer.
He should, or open a restaurant. I mean, I don't know.
Oh,
whatever.
That'd be sick too. Yeah.
These are great ideas.
But the way he talks, I think the line was something about, to not think about, like, third quarter earnings and just think about, like, what you're making that night kind of thing. It was just like, oh, wow. You are so huge and such a force that, you know, he's missing kind of like that touch and that like youthful kind of excitement and energy, and while also being around them and being a part of it, not saying that he's completely distanced from it, but just like obviously that's what he's recognizing that this book is, and that kind of like that energy.
He also kind of, I think it was funny, he sort of called out everyone in the book in a way, in a really sweet way, which is like sort of, if you look at the recipes, they look simple, you know, but then there's one thing that's very chefy. There's caviar, there's, you know, fennel pollen, there's these little touches, or it might actually be a really smart technique that's chefy for something that's really simple.
Right.
And, you know, he kind of says, like, all these chefs want you to think that they spent no time making this, but, like, these recipes are the most important things for them because it's kind of like family meal. Like, if you mess up family meal, I think that's a big deal, you know?
It is. It sets the tone for the whole night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
well,
when it's a, yeah, 100%.
Because that's the actual cooking from who you are, as opposed to the right. restaurant that you walk into every night. And, you know, he's never been on the show, so it's kind of funny. And he's just like, well, if I was on the show, this is what I would make. But also, the joy of these recipes is like, you want a bite of this, you want a bite of that, you want to like hang out and have a good time and sort of talk to like the people that you work with, because all these chefs do, working in a kitchen's really hard. I don't know if you guys ever have, but I have, and it's very difficult, and it's the type of thing where...
I'm too tall for it, so I have that.
I'm too short, so we would be a great pair. But, you know, I think it's like you spend so much time with these people, and it is sort of, whether you like them or not, like they are family. Mm-hmm. And so when you go out at the end of the night, because your adrenaline is still racing from cooking all night, you have to eat something. And so I think that in a way, this cookbook is sort of like a Bourdain book because it's speaking to the industry from the industry. Or at least that's what we hope it is. So
that's the vibe I was getting. Absolutely. I can't wait to read it. I mean, I have like the PDF file if you want it, I'll just give me an email and I'll send it to you.
But I mean, it's hosted on the Stew Podcast for download.
I'll put it up on like, but I look forward to having the tangible copy with me. Maybe I'll give it as a gift to somebody because I won't use it, you know.
You better use it. But we also have, I just want to say a shout out to Justin Hager, our illustrator, and Braden Olson, our photographer, because they really made this book look amazing. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest challenge was trying to create sort of photos that were evocative of the individual and their episode, which was really hard because there's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And then the illustrations.
There really is. To think of a cookbook with so many people, it's incredible.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge, but then also like the illustrations themselves are really funny. And if you have never seen Justin Hager's work, I definitely recommend go on Instagram. I think it's literally just like Justin Hager. He does a lot of visual puns and like play on words. And
sounds like my kind of fella.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. So
I'm gonna go back and scour the PDF for these illustrations.
They're pretty great.
I'll let you know what my favorite one is.
It's a good time. Okay, great.
All right, now's the time of the show where we talk about the best thing that we ate all week. You can go last because I just told you about this 5 minutes ago. For me, we haven't done this show in a couple weeks because we've been busy and out of town and stuff like that. And I've eaten so much stuff, but the last episode, I've eaten food literally every day since the last time we did the show. But the last episode we did was with the guy, the guy who does Bub and Grandma's Bread, which was an episode that a lot of people really loved. But he was nice enough to bring us
it was incredible.
So much bread. Like after we finished the last episode, I spent 45 minutes plastic wrapping all of the bread and putting it in our respective freezers because there was just too much.
You did a great job.
So I've been slowly just eating bread every day and figuring out how to eat it. But yesterday I was a little hungover, I will be honest. And I had a piece of his perfectly wonderful bread with just butter and Vegemite. I've been trying to work out my correct Vegemite ratios, and I think I've got it down to the point where it's there. I was over Vegemiting for a long time, and it was having a bad aftertaste. It was an overpowering thing. But once you hit the perfect ratio of butter to Vegemite, it really sings nicely.
So what is that?
What's the numerical ratio? Yeah. I would say 1 to 5 Vegemite to butter.
Mm.
And then I was talking to
top or bottom. Who's top? Who's bottoming? What's going on?
Butter goes down first, a real pool of it, too much butter. And then here's a photo, and then the Vegemite goes on top of that. Mm. So you want to see a lot of just. You want to be able to dunk an almond into that butter. There should be so much pooled up. But I never really liked Vegemite that much, and I have a lot of Australian friends, and I'm trying to absorb it. And I'm also trying to figure out how to make a Vegemite cultured butter where the Vegemite is culturing it. And I was talking to John from Cato about it, and he gave me a bunch of ideas.
Do you guys a piece of bread with butter and anchovy, or no?
I don't know if I've ever had that, actually.
I have a hard time, depending on the anchovy, I can have a hard time with that flavor profile.
He's not a big...
can do fish sauce, but some depending on the, if it's, the salt-packed, that one can be strong, but if it's, oil-packed...
No, you could do, oil, but it...
If you get the real... good quality one.
I highly recommend it. It sounds weird, but it's
no,
pretty,
no, it doesn't sound
a
weird
lot of people
all.
Grew up eating that as just their normal food, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm always trying to incorporate more oily fish into my diet.
There's moments where I've had that and I've really liked it or had it on things, but that's one ingredient that would be there's moments where I've had to choke down at a table of people if I was by myself, it would just be spit out. I'd be like, oh, not for me. And I've just been smiling, being you got it. And it's starting to sweat, trying to get it just to swallow it. And then just having to chase it with whatever's in front of me. That would be that kind of fish profile is the one flavor that can hit me hard compared to anything.
That was when I ate that beef liver carpaccio at Raku.
You've never described something to me that hit you.
Have you been
hard.
To that place, Raku?
No,
on La Cienega?
I'm familiar.
Real chefy ass spot, but they have beef liver carpaccio, and when you eat it, it tastes great going down. But then as soon as you swallow it, the whole flavor flips on its head and it transforms into the most livery, irony,
dirty
metallic,
pennies.
Just it floors you. But you put it in your mouth and you're chewing it and it tastes great. And as soon as it hits the back of your throat is when it really opens up into just a real, just a bad vibe.
I also, I'm constantly thinking about this because I can kind of do any texture. And I love eating,
nice.
I don't have a problem with off cuts. I don't have But the fish thing is the biggest part of what I have a hard time appreciating or even kind of enjoying. And both my parents don't eat a lot of seafood. Mm. And I feel
because they're mercury truthers. What's
I
up,
just
John?
Didn't grow up with it, right? I don't know. I wonder how that develops as a kid. Because I've got friends who ate lox and like smoked sturgeon as a kid, and I wonder if like that's just they're like I love it.
Jewish friends
love it. Jewish friends,
yeah.
But like not really having eaten that, I wonder because I usually can eat and enjoy anything, and that's like limiting, and I don't know why.
Did you have like a traumatic experience where a babysitter put you in the basement or something and made you eat anchovies? I don't know.
I remember I was forced to eat a canned tuna fish sandwich when I was a little kid at like a daycare, and I wouldn't eat it, and the person made me eat it. I didn't want to eat it.
Helen knows.
How'd you know?
You're an editor in chief / food trauma specialist.
But how can that be one experience that shapes like how
show
you
me
enjoy
on the tuna
something?
Can where he touched you?
Pretty much.
I mean, look, we all have like bad experiences with food. You know, it can take one experience to turn you off on something. I mean, for me,
I was just talking about this yesterday. With
but you grow out of it, I feel like.
Sometimes you do. I think that, like, if there is an experience, it could be one thing. Let's say you have food poisoning and it's something that seems really harmless. That's it fair. Might last with you for a long time.
I couldn't eat ranch dressing for like 4 years.
That's tragic.
Yeah, I know. Same. That's
yeah,
so tragic. It's,
because I went to Del Taco and they have this thing called chicken soft taco where they have like this Mexican like crema sauce, and I was like, that was so good, and I went home and I was like, I'll just make one myself with like a flour tortilla, shredded lettuce, cheese, some like turkey lunch meat instead of grilled chicken, and then I'm just gonna put ranch dressing instead of this crema, and I ate it and instantly vomited, and I could not have ranch for 4 years. And then I was doing a podcast yesterday with this guy John Gabris, and we did a podcast where you get really stoned and then you talk about a certain subject, and we were talking about leftovers. And he's like a comedian and a commercial actor, and he did an Oreo commercial where he said for an entire day he had to on camera take an Oreo, pull it apart, lick the cream, and then like put it back together, like whatever. Like, and he said he couldn't eat Oreos for 6 years after that day. And he's like a big guy who loves eating cookies, and he could not eat just because he licked an Oreo all day long.
That makes sense.
That makes sense.
Food trauma is real. That's the next book, baby.
Yeah, food trauma.
Food trauma is real.
Are you guys allergic to anything?
No. He thinks he is to dairy.
No, I'm not allergic to anything. But if I eat a lot of ice cream, I'll feel really shitty. But who doesn't? You know what I mean?
Well, you're lucky.
That's
allergic.
Why I only have one little baby scoop.
A little, yeah.
Okay,
what's your allergy?
I'm allergic to the entire squash family. So pumpkin.
Straight up and down.
Yeah. Yeah, so Halloween and fall.
The entire squash family.
It's a hellscape for me.
So we're
gourd
talking
season.
Hellscape. Gourd season is your hellscape.
Yeah.
So we're talking butternut. We're talking pumpkin. We're talking zucchini.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. When you think about it, that's a lot.
Not really. I don't really find myself eating a lot of squash.
I love squash.
I mean, you can get a sweet potato. Close your eyes. You're eating a fucking butternut. You know what I mean?
Really?
No.
I don't know. Something.
No.
Yeah, every time I've...
Near.
But nobody's ever like, oh, I really want to eat squash right now. When you eat squash, you're like, it tastes okay. Like, it's not that good.
It is very good. You're wrong. But it's also super seasonal. So when you're eating farm to table and you're eating in restaurants, that's going to be something you're going to have to dodge.
Yeah, yeah.
Winter, you're just like...
It's pretty bad. I mean,
of all the things to be allergic
to,
it's weird.
Squash is pretty low impact compared to so many. Like if you can't eat dairy or you can't eat seafood or like these big boys, like that'll fuck you up.
Well, the big boys,
squash, no biggie.
Big boys to me are either peanuts or shellfish. Like that broad spectrum stuff where it sneaks up on you or it's been packaged in something like really. Mm. Like gnarly. Because
those are the ones where if you have an allergy to it, it's like call 911.
Like the EpiPen peanut allergy.
I don't feel good. I don't think I'm going to go out. Like it's not that.
No, I think mine is like edging on that. When I used to work,
some hives.
Well,
some gourd hives.
It gets kind of crazy. I first time I had pumpkin pie was in preschool, and my throat started to close up.
Clear.
Damn.
Basically, but when I worked for Christina Tosi, she was making a butternut squash sorbet, and we were standing on the opposite sides of her bakery, and she was like, hey, this is far enough, right? And it was like, imagine the size of a gigantic bakery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yeah, yeah, that's good, that's good. And then she was juicing it, right? So just juicing a gigantic Cambro of this squash.
Oh.
And I
so just like
around,
the squash particles being in the air.
My entire face was a gigantic rash and just like red eyes. And a customer came in and I was like, hi, can I help you?
They're like, no, I'm good. Thank you.
Never coming here again.
I just wanted to make sure you were open. Bye.
So the squash became weaponized in the atmosphere.
Basically, yeah. So anyway.
Oh, it was a dirty bomb. Weaponized.
I thought you were going to say like, I came into work and I was like, ice cream. And I took a bite and it was
sure.
No.
No. Yeah. But
what? And
weird.
So did you?
I like that art. This segment is now, what's the worst thing that you ever ate?
Did you just have to go home and just be like, bye, I'm done for the day. Like, and you
did. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because when I was a kid for years, I would carve pumpkins at Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents the next day, I'd have like crazy rashes and they'd be like, oh, you're allergic to chocolate or nuts or something from Halloween.
You're allergic to fun holidays.
Yeah, and I was like, nope, that's not right. And finally, one year, I rubbed my eye, and I could not open my eye.
Wow. This is the first time I've heard, like, allergies to
me
are
so... You heard pink eye, this is like an orange eye.
Yeah.
I'm allergic to work.
Am I right, guys?
Yeah, three times.
Okay, what's the best thing you ate all week, Andre?
So we just got back from a wedding in Santa Fe, and the region is just rich with Hatch chilies, obviously. And I don't think I
too
was able to order.
Hatch chilies.
It was a struggle to not find something with Hatch chili in it. But one of the first places I ate at,
delicious. Don't need it every day.
Had just a fried Hatch chili appetizer that was like strips of Hatch chili kind of tempura'd and fried. And it was really nice.
What's the dip situation?
It was like a ranch.
Oh.
But a good ranch.
Hatch ranch.
But I think, I was just trying to think of something that, I mean, I forgot that we didn't do one for 2 weeks. So I only went back this one
week.
Over
there,
that was 5 days in Santa Fe.
Over there in Santa Fe, they call it Christmas style, where you get half green chili, half red chili sauce.
Which is fun. I did like that.
Which is fun. I got a breakfast burrito that was pretty much just a tortilla filled with burnt bacon and hash browns and covered with this half green, half red. And it was so good.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop eating it. And it was not good, but like for some reason, I really liked it. And I liked the red a lot more than the green, if I can be honest.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's got like some heat, and I think like that's actually kind of that's concentrated, that's reduced. I mean, so I think...
Because the red's dried.
Yeah, and as opposed to all the green Hatch is done fresh.
It's like an aged, like a dry-aged chili.
That's
you know
why you
what
do
I mean?
The Christmas, though. I like the blend.
Yeah, Christmas is great.
Yeah.
If you have the option to blend, you're always going to blend.
Also with Fasole, too.
If you don't blend, why are you even living still?
My big surprise about the food out there is that they treat Fasole like rice.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like you don't really get like beans and rice, you get like Fasole and rice. Because we were at a catered event that had Fasole, and I was like, where are the bowls? And they're like, no, you just put it on the plate with like everything else, and you treat it like rice. And I was like, No. I'm from LA.
Yeah,
it's a soup.
That pozole is kind of like it's like curry.
But it's fun.
Curry
I just had to be there. I had to be taught something. Mm-hmm. About
did you
it.
Guys go to Parasols when you were there?
No.
No.
We should have talked to you before we went to the wedding.
Yeah.
It's like a women's clothing boutique.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you can get really good pantsuits there.
Mm.
No, they have basically so it's a local kind of I don't want to say chain in Santa Fe, but they make this incredible crispy taco, and it has Hatch chili covered in it, and it's just like...
I would have loved to have eaten that.
The best thing. Like, every time I go to Santa Fe, it's
I feel like we scoured every inch of Santa Fe,
and we did not
see a single Parasols.
Reading, talking to locals, we didn't get the pro tip. That was my first time being there,
We should have done this pod pre-wedding. Or they should have pushed the wedding back next time. All right, what's the best thing that you had all week? Aside from the almonds and coffee.
It's not always also best, just fun. Whatever you like.
I'm trying to think.
Maybe just a noteworthy one.
Or
maybe what you're looking forward to eating while you're in LA on holiday.
Yeah, well, so I've been going a lot to a new restaurant in Lower Manhattan. It's right near Mission Chinese. It's called
Sweet Green.
Is it a poke spot?
It's called McDonald's.
How bad is Sweet Green? I think it sucks. What do you think?
I think it's fine. You don't have to answer his rude questions.
I like salad.
Yeah, me too. That's why I see Sweet Green is sacrilege.
Anywho, salad, correct? I really like...
There's something there.
Servos. It's a new restaurant. It's Portuguese.
Servos?
Mm-hmm. This guy, Nick Perkins, who used to be at Diner and Marlowe and Sons, is the chef and owner there. And it's super good. And they just make all the food that you want to eat. It's like they have fresh oysters. They have... these gigantic shrimp that are cooked in this kind of spicy chili sauce, clams in a white wine sauce, jamon, I mean, a little sherry, good wine.
Servos.
Servos, yeah.
That sounds really nice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next time I go to New York, I'm going to sniff around servos.
Where should I go eat tonight?
That's what, that was the question.
I'm really feeling some cold Korean soup.
Yeah.
But also, like, I'm a little on the hangover-y, so, like, now this double-double talk is starting to perk my interest a little bit.
I feel like it's too hot, though, right? Like, it's so hot outside.
I know, it's so, yeah, but also, like, I think a Koreatown is going to be the move, like, a cold soup, and then maybe, like, a nice acai bowl for dessert.
Inside Wind Spa.
Oh.
That'll work.
Dude, hit the Wii Spa cold sauna, the ice room.
What about a charcuterie plate, a quisbaca with rosé?
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stop. Stop it right now. But also, I had nachos for dinner last night, and so I should probably have like a more responsible meal that's not so bad for me.
Mm-hmm.
I need some nutrients tonight.
Some bulgur.
What sounds really good to eat tonight in L.A.?
I was thinking about...
It's going to be Korean.
Have you had the tacos dorado, the shrimp tacos dorado from Mariscos Jalisco's?
Yes.
Okay.
So good. What is it? Sap?
Oh, Sap Coffee Shop.
I was kind of wanting to go there.
Have you been there?
Yes.
It's like, you know,
it's so good.
2 minutes from here.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean...
The jade noodle with the duck?
I think the problem...
Just don't go to Kismet and you'll be good.
God damn it. Fair.
Actually, I went to Kismet like 3 times the last time I was here. So, no, I feel like LA has so much to offer. It's kind of overwhelming. So,
truly
I don't
is.
Know.
Yeah, so, yeah. My Lyft driver was like, he's from New York, and he's like, California, it's not really, or LA is not a city. It's like more of a state. He said LA is sort of like New Jersey, where it's just a bunch of little towns connected by roads.
I agree completely.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And I was like, how dare you call us New Jersey? 1 star. Helen, thank you so much for doing the show. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And if you want to go check out Munchies' first new cookbook, you can pre-order it on Munchies.com, I guess.
Munchies.tv or, you know, your favorite retailer, whether it's
Amazon.
It's
on Amazon, all that shit.
Urban
Late Night Meals from the world's best chefs. You can follow me on social media at themjeans. Andre Canaparo has no social media because he's cool.
TheStewPodcast.com
is the website where everything lives. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
See you guys next week. I'm just beginning. The pen's in my hand. Ending a plan. Staring at the blank page before you. Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you cannot find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost